Dude, Jerry Adelman is in the studio,
well,
by the
just
way.
Just recently, I heard Tom Friedman give a talk, and he's calling it now global weirding. But just to this point, I mean, these extremes, unpredictable, you know, and clearly that's what's happening. It's scary.
And Blake Davis, of course, was on the show in January, and he just so did you got to go to the talk?
No, we had our Master Gardener meeting that night. We had recognized our graduates. But some of the folks did go and reported back. And it's I think his discussion is going to be posted on the Chicago Bioneers webpage.
That was hosted by Chicago Bioneers, I believe. Yeah, because he originally did the talk for the Bioneers conference in November, last November. Then he was on the show. And Jerry, have you heard Blake Davis
speak?
I have
not.
Yeah. All right, because he's working with the plant on the south side.
I mean, I know the name, but I've never heard him.
And he's from IIT and working with John Adel at the plant on the south side. And he has this talk called the 50-Year Survival Plan for Climate Change. And I wouldn't say it's dystopian, but it's not particularly encouraging to think what he says. And I know this is of interest to you because these are the kinds of things you're dealing with in open lands. It's a part of the reason you preserve the land is to preserve our planet the way it is and mitigate some of the effects of development, encroaching development. But Blake has this theory that it's all going to go downhill for the next 50 years. And even right now, he says the next 10 years will have the illusion of being business as usual. But meanwhile, the markets will be skidding. I mean, regardless of what you see on Wall Street right now. And it's going to and then suddenly the bottom will fall out and it's going to get a little crazy. And you can believe it or you cannot believe it. I happen to think that if we don't take action and we don't have more people like you on the planet and more people who like the ones who work for open lands, we're going to be in big trouble. I think we're already in a heap of trouble. And I don't mean to scare people on a Sunday morning here. You know, we want to be positive because you're celebrating 50 years at open lands and the great work you've done there. But we're not working hard enough. And that probably makes you sweat a little bit, you know.
No, I think it's absolutely true. And clearly our political leaders have to have more backbone. I think
there you go.
You know, I mean, there's things we can do as individuals, and we all should.
Well,
there's
no
question because cumulatively it makes a difference. It also creates a culture, you know, of caring and concern. But in the big picture, you know, if we don't have leadership at the policy level, local, state, and obviously national, and then global, you know, we're in big trouble.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, you will hear people say, well, the politicians can't do it if they don't have the directive from their constituents. The constituents, I think, have been pretty clear on it.
Yeah.
And I think it's obstruction, pure and simple. It's a handful of backward thinking people who think that we can just turn the clock back and go to where we were in the 1920s or wherever they want to go, including what has happened to the planet, including the amount of carbon dioxide we've pumped into the atmosphere. Yeah. We can't go back there. Yeah. We have to move forward.
I think you know that for 20-some years I've done volunteer work through Columbia University in New York in China, mainly in the southwest in Yunnan province, which is a very culturally and naturally rich place. But it's interesting, the recent 18th Party Congress, you know, one of the five major priorities is the environment. And suddenly there's a lot more transparency. We're hearing about, you know, air quality issues, which are unbearable and so forth. So, you know, things can change. Now, will it in China? I don't know. But at least it's on the radar screen. There's far more transparency than there ever had been. So that to me is...
But that's a relative term there, isn't it?
Very. No question. No question. And I'm not putting that up as a model. I'm just saying that we're seeing some change at the highest levels in terms of people can't stick their heads in the sand. We've got to deal with these issues.
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I've read about this too. It's not going to do any good to point fingers at China, even though there's more than a billion people and they contribute a lot to this, especially as they move forward with their industry. But
we've got to show the leadership.
Yeah, we're not showing leadership. No. Come on, and I don't want to drag you into a political discussion here because But, you know, I'm the radio guy, so I get to do
that's
that.
That's your role.
That's my role. And
Provocative and challenging.
I hope so. I don't know.
Always.
But my feeling right now is there's no reason in hell for Barack Obama to approve the Keystone XL pipeline. I don't see any reason at all except to cave into industry. And regardless of where the oil would – tar sands oil would be going and where the money's going, it's a symbol. It's a symbol of something, and we need a symbol right now to show that we are taking the lead in the world on this. And if nothing else, rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline sends that message to the world. And that's what I – that's my personal opinion on it, is that if you don't do that, not only have you not sent us a message, you have caved completely on your promises. And – you know, then we have to, you know, and it's like you said earlier, we don't have the political will, we have nothing.
Yep.
So,
true.
And I have to bring this up as well. You got sucked into this vortex, Jerry. By the way, that's Jerry Adelman, who's the president and CEO of Openlands, just so you know. And he is my punching bag at the moment. No, you're not. I would never do that. But we have to take a second here, because I know people listening are wondering, and I know Dick Kay talked about this a little bit yesterday, which is the passage of the fracking regulatory bill in Illinois. The moratorium obviously did not get passed. It never really had the support of the General Assembly. So for those folks who thought it was going to happen, all I know is from what I hear from my folks, people I talked to, and they said, well, that really wasn't going to happen, and that's why we really had to do the regulatory bill. And, you know, if you see the headlines say it's going to be the strictest set of rules in the country, and that's a good thing. But the problem is, how lax have the rules been elsewhere? And so it's a relative thing as well. Just to let you know, I will be talking about this on the show, not today, because I had Jerry book and I had other folks booked here, and I don't have the time to go into this, but I am going to bring some of the people into the studio who were involved in those negotiations and discussions about what the bill should be, and we need to talk about
and
that.
And, Mike, one very positive thing that came out of the legislature, which you may be aware of, but is finally, after 7 years, they approved this recreational liability bill.
And I'm glad you brought that up.
Those protections had been taken away from private property owners who would open up their land to the public for hiking, biking, bird watching, hunting, fishing, whatever. And the hunting and fishing side got protection, but the rest were taken away. Strange history.
That's
there.
Just
But
bizarre.
Anyway, it's now been reestablished.
And weren't we the only state that didn't have that protection? Or something like that, or close to that?
You know, I don't know that, to be honest. Uh-huh. I'm sure Lenore Beyer-Clough, our policy director, could tell you if we were. But anyway, it was, I think, a huge victory. It takes us back to where we were, but at least we're there.
But
and that's
the point is that people who are birding, who are hiking, and they're on private land can feel that they've not risking their livelihoods and their lives.
Well, it's not so much that. It's also the private property owner who allows
the
them
the property.
That's
yeah.
really the direction more. And so, you know, obviously there are some wonderful private lands adjacent to public holdings along our rivers and streams and forests and so forth that people have been willing in the past to make available. This mm-hmm. is also true for not-for-profits. So, for instance, we have this over a mile of Lake Michigan shoreline, you know, the southern part of the former Fort Sheridan, our Open Lands Lakeshore Preserve.
Which is wonderful.
And thank you. It would be as true for us as it was for a private property owner, a farmer, or whatever, who would make his land available.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I did get that wrong. But it's the protection to the property owners, and you want to encourage property owners to let these people on their lands
Absolutely.
To enjoy this.
Absolutely.
Because let's face it, not all the beautiful sites in the state are public.
No, nor are they permanently protected. And so, you know, this fits into that kind of mosaic of what are the lands that we have, public and private? How do we use them? How do we care for them? What kind of accessibility do they have? You want to create incentives for private property owners to be good stewards, to protect and restore their land, but also where appropriate to make it available to the public.
So now those private property owners can allow people on and not risk their
being sued.
Being sued and so forth. Now, you talked about this mosaic that leads us right into Hackmatack.
Yes.
Which you open lands. And we're going to get to the 50th anniversary celebration in it. But this is all part of it. This is all part of what Openlands does. And the Hackmatack National Wildlife Refuge, which was signed into law a year ago, November, right? I think.
I don't even think it was that.
Was it just this past year?
It was this past year.
It was just this past year.
I know how time passes.
I know. I just thought, oh my goodness. No, you're right. It's this past year.
Yeah.
And that's part of that mosaic.
2012, I think, is when it was established.
That's right. You're right. No,
so
you're right.
It seems like forever.
Oh my goodness. It seems like forever, but it hasn't been. But that's part of that whole mosaic idea that you have public and private and you work together.
Yeah, a shared vision, really. And, you know, we, as a metropolitan area, this is kind of the greater Milwaukee, Rockford, Chicago area, had no National Wildlife Refuge. So this is significant in many ways in terms of, you know, bringing resources to this huge metropolitan population, the largest between the coasts, and hopefully bringing a spirit of partnership, public and private. So this will be a mosaic of lands, existing public holdings that County Forest Preserve, state, and other entities have, but also with a strategy to link them through trails and add additional lands. Only willing sellers, you know, so this is a very...
you're not snapping up all the land. You're also working with...
Oh, totally. With private property owners, encouraging easements, encouraging, you know, restoration and protection of those lands. So it's a strategy, really, to think at a landscape scale and to recognize that this area, sort of northern Illinois, mainly McHenry County, going up into Wisconsin towards Lake Geneva, that there's just an amazing landscape there of... you know, threatened and endangered species, but spectacular scenery, recreational opportunities, you know, extraordinary habitat, and that this frames all of this important land in a way that we can think about it as a system and what's needed, you know, in terms of acquisition, in terms of private management and so forth.
Was this a completely new idea? Because unlike other refuges, you couldn't just grab a section of land and say, okay, we're protecting that. You had to negotiate with people and figure out, okay, this parcel might work and that parcel might work. Where else has that model been done in the country?
Well, I think actually a number of the wildlife refuges have similar characteristics. And again, it's not the federal government coming in, buying everything up. There's no condemnation. It doesn't change underlying zoning and so forth. So that's part of the system, the approach. This all started really around a kitchen table in McHenry County. Concerned citizens who said, you know, we've got something special here. And how do we elevate it? You know, how do we escalate our preservation efforts? How do you bring value added? And so that's where it really started. And I don't know that, you know, with the other national wildlife refuges around the country, how many of them had such a grassroots beginning. But clearly, that was the case here.
I always say that the people, there must be something in the water in McHenry County. They're such good conservationists. And I think it also has to do with it's one of the last areas to be developed in this region.
True. And Lenore, I mentioned before, Lenore Byer-Clough, our policy director, lives in McHenry County and has been very involved there. So it was a great convergence of, you know, her relationships and passion for that land and her role heading, you know, our policy work as a regional player to partner then with McHenry County Conservation District, a whole slew of not-for-profits and Sierra Club and others, you know, who this broad coalition that made it happen, public and private, really extraordinary.
But know. All these people working together, but it seems to me that getting Openlands behind it as well is, one of the things that you've been able to do as an organization and over the years, and I have the feeling it's due to your leadership since 1980, at least in part, is leverage some of these things with you're able to sometimes temporarily buy land and then lease it back or sell it back, and you know, just being able to work things that way has been a great boon to conservation in the area.
Well, it's really a hallmark of the organization from its very founding back in 1963. You know, we were created as a a project. We were called originally Open Lands Project of the Welfare Council of Metropolitan Chicago. Unlikely place when you think, you know, conservation group. But yeah. There were people who realized that because of trends in Illinois and nationally, you know, the GI Bill, the Highway Act, and so forth, that larger tracts of land were being opened to sort of haphazard development without much coordination. And Northeastern Illinois has more units of local government than any other metropolitan area in the country. Well, when you add in then Wisconsin and Indiana, you know, the southern shore of Lake Michigan, it's kind of Tower of Babel. So there was very little coordination. There were no groups in the country or only a couple that focused on conservation in a metropolitan area. We're real pioneers in that sense. And when you think back to the time, I mean, you know, a year before, Rachel Carson publishes Silent Spring. I mean, it's kind of the birth of the environmental movement. But it was connecting people to land. It was looking at quality of life. I mean, concern about the environment in and of itself, but also the impacts on our lives and how it enriches the lives and that all people should have access to nature close to where they live, be it a community garden or, you know, a wildlife refuge out in the fringes. And so open lands knew as a small little group that it could only get its work done by working in partnership. So I think the Hackmatack model you see replicated as you go back in time, countless projects, I&M Canal, National Heritage Corridor, the old Plank Road Trail, Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore was one of the early things that we got involved with, you know, again, working with many partners, sometimes in the lead, often, not always, but there, you know, in the front lines, you know, working to make it happen.
We're going to have to break in a second, but maybe this is not a fair question, but how is it that you separate yourselves, Open Lands, from other conservation groups and even other groups like the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning and Sierra Club and other organizations out there? What is it at the core of Open Lands that sets you apart?
Well, first of all, we predate a lot of those groups. We're not-for-profit, so CMAP, of course, is government, as an example. But we look comprehensively at this kind of green space system for our three-state metropolitan area. So that web of green that ties us together, we look at all dimensions of that, you know, from a community garden or a recreational park to a hiking biking trail to, you know, large reserves to restoring wetlands and other natural resources. But again, that kind of web of green that ties us all together. We deal with the policy side of it, the advocacy side. We pioneer programs that illustrate things. So we have this comprehensive, you know, metropolitan vision, if you want, and work at all these different scales. We work in partnership, though. So, you know, we were a founding member of Chicago Wilderness, which now is, what, about 270 agencies, organizations, institutions, you know, working in this region along the southern shore of Lake Michigan. So we work in partnership always, but we do have kind of a unique niche in that we weave all those little pieces together and big pieces, you know, into a comprehensive vision for the metropolitan area as a whole.
That answers it pretty well. Okay, that is Jerry Adelman, who's the president and CEO of Open Lands. Okay, you got to ask Rob or Sarah. I see a tweet here about who coined global weirding. Hunter Levins, is that it? Or Levins? Hunter Levins, co-founder of Rocky Mountain Institute.
Yep.
Okay.
It could be, I mean, as I said, Tom Friedman used it, so that's where I first heard it.
Yeah. So, well, you know, it when it becomes popular, you know, somebody's got to copyright it if they want to get their nickel for it.
Alabama, Arkansas, I do love my mom, Paul.
Sing it, Sarah. Come on. You can sing along with that. All right. I have to tell you this. Before we get back to Jerry Adelman, I was listening to the radio the other day, and somebody mentioned Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. And my friend Max said, oh, I have no idea who that is. I said, yes, you do. She says, no, I don't. I said, yes, you do. If you've heard this song, you know, which is like everywhere, I say, you know, you just don't know the name. You know, of course, Kathleen says, oh, that's really good. Tell somebody that they don't know at all what they're talking about. But,
well, you know, Mike, that's a little bit like Open Lands. You go to Volo Bog, you go to the Prairie Path, you visit Goose Lake Prairie, you know, so many sites throughout our region, you don't connect it with open lands. We're kind of invisible that way, which isn't bad. But because we don't own and manage these sites that we've advocated for, in some cases actually purchased but passed on, as you indicate, to, you know, public agencies, you see the result of our work. You experience it, but you don't necessarily connect it to us.
You know, that's a really good point, and I don't Well, let me just say, does that create an image problem for you? Do you think, because you are so much behind the scenes.
We are. And I think...
I mean, you're behind tree keepers as
right.
well. I'm a tree keeper. You've got garden keepers. You've got all these different things that you do, these wonderful programs.
Well, thanks to people like you, I think the word is getting out that it's Open Lands who does these things. But we are a well-kept secret in some ways. We aren't a household name necessarily, but we've been around 50 years and we've played a really pioneering role. I feel so honored to be connected with this organization. And so many of the causes that we take on, our policy efforts, as well as site-specific you know, programs that lead to protecting these wonderful spaces and creating them as you know, assets for the general public, people don't make the connection necessarily. We've given birth to a lot of groups. You know, in 1971, Lake Michigan Federation was launched as the now the Alliance for Great Lakes. In 1988, after 10 years being with us as a special program, Friends of the Chicago River went independent. You know, we Canal Corridor Association, a group that I founded in 1982 to provide leadership along the 100-mile I&M Canal National Heritage Corridor, to name a few. Mm-hmm. So we've given birth, you know, to a number of important projects, but also organizations.
Well, you also aid organizations, and for instance, the Chicago Recycling Coalition, which I'm president of. You let us come into your boardroom and have our meetings. Now, I can't tell you how much we appreciate it because we don't have our own clubhouse.
And we do that all the time, and we see that that's an appropriate role. You know, we're located right down the loop. It's kind of easy to get there. You can come by various public transportation. We haven't not a fancy conference room, but a fine conference room.
It's just fine. Believe me.
And so we host, you know, groups all the time. And we feel that, you know, as an umbrella kind of for this region, looking at all dimensions, again, of open space, land and water, you know, recognizing that nature is important to all people wherever they live. Well, we want to make sure that we're a partner and that we also support other efforts, grassroots and partner organizations, you know, throughout the metropolitan area.
One of the ways you can tell how effective and important you are is every year Open Lands has a luncheon. I believe in October.
Yep, this year, October 25th. It'll be at the Hilton Hotel.
Okay, give it a plug.
Avenue.
Go for
hey,
it.
Yeah.
Wait. There you go. There's your plug.
Okay, good. October 25th at the Chicago Hilton.
Who's speaking?
We have Dr. Michael Suk, who is a medical doctor but has been a leader nationally in park prescriptions and in talking about the role that nature plays in wellness and human well-being. We're really showcasing that connection to health and wellness that our parks and natural areas provide and how important it is, you know, in so many ways, early childhood development, obesity, diabetes, psychological health, reducing violence, a whole range of things. So he's our speaker. We're honoring Judith Stockdale. We felt it was very appropriate in our 50th year. Judith had been executive director of Open Lands, went on then a very illustrious career in the environmental arena, working in the Chicago Community Trust, the first director of the Great Lakes Protection Fund. And now for 18 years, she just retired from that position as director of the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. It has been such an important funder of so many conservation efforts here and in the Lowcountry of South Carolina. So she's our honoree. But, you know, it's going to be a reunion. We're inviting former staff and board. And in fact, the night before, for our family, our immediate family, board and staff, past and present, one of our board members is hosting a dinner. And then we're just hoping that, you know, all of our partners and friends, you know, will be with us on the 25th.
Well, what I was going to say is that every year that's a place where environmentalists gather and they schmooze.
Yeah. 800 people last
800
year.
People.
It's amazing.
I know. It's unbelievable. We love being there, and I come because usually I get invited by a group and say, hey, you want to sit at our table?
Don't worry, you will.
It's like I have to glom on to somebody's table usually. But it's amazing how many people I know in the room.
Yeah.
I'm always...
It's kind of the reunion of the conservation community in so many ways, you know, from throughout the metropolitan area and people from different backgrounds,
and it's also,
public, private.
And it's humbling because I can remember walking away last year from the luncheon and the speakers you had, and I thought, oh, what have I done with my life?
Oh, God, no.
These people are just the movers, and the things they've accomplished are so unbelievable.
Mike, look at what you do. And I don't say have done because you continue to do it, but what a voice, you know, in our region, and we thank you for it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have people like you on the show so we can get the word out, which takes us to your 50th anniversary celebration, which is going to be at this wonderful place that you just started. I love the idea that you're coming right back to the Openlands Lakeshore Preserve to do your 50th.
Well, yeah, and it's a little misleading because we're doing many things in the 50th year. That's
right.
A kind of very high-end, you know, a fundraiser. We
want to
raise funds for our wonderful thing. I'm not discouraged. It's going to be a great event.
Yeah.
June 15th. Songs of Praise, we're calling it, and it's going to be a very interesting program, a really special thing. But we've had a variety of things going on during this year that will continue and really culminating with our luncheon. So all of those things celebrate our 50th. This just is a special milestone.
Well, okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that as the special milestone, and then some of the other things that that are going to be happening this year. You're going to have a dinner, and like you said, it's kind of high end.
And you know, it's opportunity for corporations, and wealthy individuals, and so forth.
But you
to
know
support
what?
Us
I think about that as I was putting this together, and I thought, well, yeah. I can't really afford this, but but on the other hand, I want you guys to continue doing what you do, which is why you do things
like
this.
And, you know, you look at, you know, various cultural institutions and environmental groups and so forth, too, and so many of them do have a very high-end ball, or they have, you know, whatever, Friends of the Park says their big ball, for instance, and so forth. And so we typically don't do that. We just have our luncheon. We try to keep the price relatively reasonable, you know, and we invite many of our partners and friends as well. But this, we thought for the anniversary was a special time and to do something that is more high end. And
why not?
You know, yeah.
And you're going to be on a bluff.
Oh, it's a spectacular setting. I mean, you know our Lakeshore Preserve.
Yeah.
I mean, this is over a mile of Lake Michigan shoreline, three ravines, these bluffs, the upland area. And it would not be protected but for us. I mean, to Senator Kirk's credit, when he was congressman, the southern part of the fort was going to be redeveloped, and he contacted us. He said, we're going to redevelop it for Navy housing, market rate housing. It was the non-historic part. We had been involved in the early 90s in making sure that the historic part of the fort to the north, that almost 700 acres of land remained in the public domain. It got transferred to the Lake County Forest Preserve District. So help us find someone who can take it over. We turned to all the usual suspects. Everybody was supportive, said it has to be saved. But for various reasons, legitimate ones, they weren't in a position to do it. As you indicated, you know, we've saved tens of thousands of acres. We buy land, but we aren't permanent owners of it. We pass it on. So we went back to him and said, we can't find anyone. He said, well, if you don't take it, then this will be a gated community and we'll have high rises. And so little of our lakefront outside the city of Chicago is in the public domain, and almost none of the bluff and ravine. So with the northern Lake County Forest Preserve property, over 2 miles, you know, it's really spectacular.
It's unbelievable.
So we've been doing massive restoration, as you know, trail development. We've incorporated public art, which is a very powerful way to kind of connect people. It's a special
place. You know, that's a really good point, too. I think what is underestimated is how much you use art in your in installations and the projects that you sponsor. I love the idea of incorporating art.
And that's been a theme, you know, in the history of the organization. Photographic exhibitions. I mean, many people saw Revealing Chicago, Terry Evans' wonderful show in Millennium Park. That might have been the highest profile. But we've done things at the Field Museum, at the Art Institute, and galleries, public art in our community gardens, murals, and other kinds of sculpture and so forth. But, you know, art and artists have a way of connecting with people that's very powerful. And not everybody relates, you know, to things in the same way. And so we've seen that can be a vehicle that engages broader audiences, gives a point of entry, you know, into bigger themes about
and
our environment.
And it also, you know, art is so important in our lives. We need that grace note well to show how connected nature and art really are on a certain level in terms of our beings.
Right. And I think, you know, our society's become so fragmented and, you know, kind of narrowly focused, different special interests and so forth. You know, we want to incorporate nature into all aspects of our lives, and art is a dimension of that. The aesthetics are a dimension of that, and we need to have a more holistic vision, I think, of society as a whole and the relationship that humans and nature have together and the importance of that.
If you want more information about this, you can go to openlands.org and see the 50th anniversary celebration. As Jerry Adelman said, who is here, president and CEO, going on all year. The last thought before you leave, you must look at the region and recognize the urgency of doing what you do more than ever, because we're running out of open space and things that we can actually save. How's that going to manifest itself in the near future?
Well, as an organization, we just completed a strategic plan, and so we're kind of looking at that context and figuring out how we can build our capacity, but the capacity of society as a whole. And so I think, you know, there are various ways, but we need to inspire leadership at all levels, and we need to connect people to these important issues that we're facing. And so programs like yours are one vehicle, and it's really important. And increasingly, I think we just need to talk about these things, and we need to engage people, recognizing that they're the stewards, and that if we don't do things, it won't be there for future generations. In a very real sense, we're talking about losing the opportunity. So there's still some important things that we can do in terms of protecting land, making it accessible, restoring its function ecologically, and addressing these bigger societal issues of the environment that you touched on when we first opened.
Like I said, go to openlands.org. Jerry Adelman, always a pleasure to have. I love it when you come into the studio.
Well, it's a treat to be here.
He comes in with his briefcase, so I figure he's off to some other meeting probably from this. So thanks again, and we'll talk in the very near future.
My pleasure. Thank you.